Thank you to the founding sponsor of Undivided, 1530 Mortgage. Visit them at 1530mortgage.com. Today, Joe Rogan gives a masterclass in how to respond to controversy.
If there's anything that I've done that I could do better is have more experts with differing opinions right after I have the controversial ones.
Plus, if you think you've heard of every crazy idea ever to come out of Seattle City Hall, well, buckle up. And finally, some thoughts on the passing of former Washington State Trooper Robert LeMay, who had strong words himself for Governor Jay Inslee when he lost his job over the vaccine mandate.
This is my final sign-off. After 22 years of serving the citizens of the state of Washington, I'm being asked to leave because I am dirty.
Welcome to the Undivided Podcast. I'm Brandi Cruz. Thanks for listening. On the podcast last week, I talked a little bit, I touched a tiny bit at the end about this whole Joe Rogan saga. At the time, it had to do with Neil Young saying, basically, pull my songs from Spotify if you're not going to pull Joe Rogan. And I had said at the time, you know, no, there's no way Neil Young expected for Spotify to side with him over Joe Rogan. There's just no way. And so if he, you know, made a decision to protest with his songs and pull them, have them pulled off Spotify, I don't really care. I mean, that's his prerogative. Joni Mitchell pulled her songs off Spotify as well in solidarity with Neil Young. I mean, some people are saying, oh, they're throwing a hissy fit. They're canceling themselves. They are making a decision about where they want their music to be housed. And if they don't want it to be housed on Spotify, then honestly, who cares? That's up to them. And I was reading on Billboard that this represents for them about a 10% hit to their annual revenue by not having their music on Spotify. Their songs, their money, their decision. I am bothered not by it. The bigger controversy, of course, is where is this going and how is Spotify going to respond? We know that there, if you go to the Dave Chappelle controversy with Netflix, there are a million examples of people trying to pressure and silence voices by targeting the platforms that those voices reside on. And the key issue here is some people believe that Joe Rogan is spreading misinformation on COVID, and they say that that's dangerous. Now, I tend to think that people who are levying such a broad criticism against Joe Rogan have probably not listened to his podcasts. Justin Amash, who's a former member of Congress, put it really well. He tweeted out, people trust Joe Rogan not because he's always right, but because he's transparent, curious, gracious, humble about knowledge, and willing to consider perspectives that challenge and reshape his own thinking. We need more of this in media, in politics, in business, in life. And that's true. Joe Rogan has admitted when he's been wrong. He's admitted it on his show when he's been wrong in the moment. And he doesn't sit there and push his views on his guests. He's there to learn from his guests, ask his guests questions, challenge his guests, and if necessary, admit that his guests are right and he is wrong. Now, I will tell you, you can learn everything you need to know about Joe Rogan based on his response to the Spotify controversy. Someone who is fringe, right-wing, would have come out and probably made fun of Neil Young and Joni Mitchell and tore them apart for contributing to cancel culture and for being reactionary or petty, but Joe Rogan didn't do that. He came out and he actually apologized to both of them, saying he's sorry that they felt the need to remove their music from Spotify over him.
I'm very sorry that they feel that way. I most certainly don't want that.
He actually also thanked the people who have been hating on him over all of this for making him take a closer look at what he's doing.
It's good to have some haters. It makes you reassess what you're doing and put things into perspective, and I think that's good too.
But very importantly about this video that Joe Rogan posted on his Instagram, it was about a 9-10 minute video, is that he didn't say he was going to stop talking about controversial issues. He didn't say he was going to stop having on controversial guests. He didn't say he was going to stop questioning the prevailing narrative. First, he clearly laid out the intention of his show for those who might be part of this outrage, but don't really understand his show or haven't listened to his show.
The problem I have with the term misinformation, especially today, is that many of the things that we thought of as misinformation just a short while ago are now accepted as fact. Like, for instance, 8 months ago, if you said, if you get vaccinated, you can still catch COVID and you can still spread COVID, you would be removed from social media. They would ban you from certain platforms. Now, that's accepted as fact. If you said, I don't think cloth masks work, you would be banned from social media. Now, that's openly and repeatedly stated on CNN. If you said, I think it's possible that COVID-19 came from a lab, you'd be banned from many social media platforms. Now, that's on the cover of Newsweek. All of those theories that at one point in time were banned were openly discussed by those two men that I had on my podcast that have been accused of dangerous misinformation. I do not know if they're right. I don't know because I'm not a doctor. I'm not a scientist. I'm just a person who sits down and talks to people and has conversations with them. Do I get things wrong? Absolutely, I get things wrong, but I try to correct them. Whenever I get something wrong, I try to correct it because I'm interested in telling the truth. I'm interested in finding out what the truth is. And I'm interested in having interesting conversations with people that have differing opinions.
And finally, he talked about solutions. He talked about what he is willing to do moving forward, not because he feels like he has to do it, but because he thinks it's actually a good idea.
One of the things that Spotify wants to do that I agree with is that at the beginning of these controversial podcasts, like specifically ones about COVID, is to put a disclaimer and say that you should speak with your physician and that these people and the opinions that they express are contrary to the opinions of the consensus of experts, which I think is very important. Sure, have that on there. I'm very happy with that. Also, I think if there's anything that I've done that I could do better is have more experts with differing opinions right after I have the controversial ones. I would most certainly be open to doing that.
This video statement from Joe Rogan is a masterclass in how to respond to controversy. How to respond to controversy in a way that doesn't encourage and feed the cancel culture crowd, that doesn't denigrate anyone, that doesn't inflame things, that involves a critical and thoughtful analysis about what's at the heart of the controversy, what can be done to ease the controversy and the anger. Joe Rogan isn't just giving the outraged crowd what they want because they're angry. He is using all of this as an opportunity to do some self-reflection, to assess whether there is something that he should be doing differently, particularly given the size of his platform, and ultimately how he can make his podcast better, how he can make his podcast more informative. So at the end of the day, Joe Rogan comes out of this winning. Anyone who is ever at the center of a controversy of cancel culture needs to watch this full video from Joe Rogan and learn some lessons on how to respond in a way that is productive, not reactive. And I can only speak for myself as someone who has been at the center of cancel culture attempts before when I say that I will be taking some cues from that video myself. By now, I'm sure you've seen my commercials for the founding sponsor of Undivided, 1530 Mortgage, and I wanted to tell you a little bit more about them. 1530 Mortgage stands for the 15 and 30 year mortgage, and the 1530 Mortgage Act stands for accountability, communication, time, and transparency. Find out more at 1530mortgage.com or call 206-207-7777. 1530 Mortgage, NMLS number 1761573, Equal Housing Opportunity. On now to a story about a protest that just won't fade from the headlines because it was just, oh, such a mess. Such a mess. Chop Chaz, of course, most of you listening will know what that is. In 2020, during the height of unrest following the death of George Floyd in Minneapolis, in Seattle, protesters took over about a 6-square block segment of the city that included the police department's East Precinct for a period of about a month. It was first dubbed CHAZ, the Capitol Hill Autonomous Zone, and then it was dubbed CHOP, the Capitol Hill Occupied Protest. And it was a big, giant mess. And eventually the city just abandoned the East Precinct. Officers packed up their stuff, including plaques on the walls, and put them in moving vans and left. And there was a lot of discussion around the time and speculation about, are police going to move back in? Are they going to give this building over to the protesters? And there was a lot of denial that that would be considered. And some people were talking about, and I know protesters were saying that they wanted the building given to community. Keep in mind, you know, this precinct is positioned in a way that makes it absolutely critical for 911 response calls in that area of the city. So at the time, you know, I remember thinking, well, there's no way they're going to give up a police precinct. That's absolutely absurd. Well, apparently they were considering it. The Seattle Times out with an article. The headline, as police were abandoning East Precinct, Seattle officials drafted plan to give station to a Black Lives Matter group. The article by Daniel Beekman and Lewis Cam. Citing newly released documents, they report, at the height of Seattle's racial justice protests in 2020, then-Mayor Jenny Durkin's administration drafted legislation to transfer the police department's East Precinct building to a Black Lives Matter activist organization and researched relocating the station's operations. Now, the Seattle Times characterizes this as a brief contemplation of giving the building over. Apparently, this would have gone to a group called Black Lives Matter Seattle King County, effective July 1st, 2020, had the city moved forward with this. By that time, it had been about a month since protesters took over the area. And the Seattle Times reports that the group wanted to maybe make it a community hub and a public health hub for the community. Now, Mayor Durkin is out of office, of course, as of January 1st. And one of the other challenges here is, as you guys know, there are months of missing text messages from the mayor, from the police chief, from the fire chief, and other city officials during this critical period of time during unrest in the city of Seattle. And so we don't know to the extent that this idea was discussed in text messages. All we have now, thanks to the Seattle Times in a public disclosure request, is this memo that's sort of a mock-up for whether this would be feasible. Ultimately, the city, according to the Times, decided it wasn't in the best interest of... This is a quote. I've got to read this for you. Chelsea Kellogg, who's a spokesperson for the former mayor, said in an email to the Times, "The very preliminary work by FAS and the realities of policing confirmed it was neither feasible nor in the best interest of public safety." You don't say. Where along the line, and with whom, did the idea begin, the possibility, the contemplation, that giving up an entire police precinct in a major U.S. city could be, might be, in the interest of public safety? You just wonder what's going on behind the scenes in government sometimes. A couple other interesting wrinkles to this story, because there's been some depositions going on. Of course, there are businesses up in the area formerly known as CHOP that are suing the city because they went through hell during that period of time. A former deputy mayor, Casey Sixkiller, had actually said during a deposition that it was the activists who ended up deciding that they didn't want the building, suggesting that it wasn't the city that gave up on this idea, that it was the activists who said, nah, we don't want your crappy building, because it is precinct. I mean, it is kind of crappy. And to make matters worse, the police department tells the Times they had no knowledge of this, that it was purely a conversation happening at City Hall. The police department wasn't clued in on it. And maybe that's because it didn't get to that stages, but you'd think that the very first people you would consult about giving up a police precinct, an active police precinct, especially at a time of rising 911 response times, would be the police department. You think that'd be the first department that you'd clue in to this conversation. There's also a back and forth about who wanted a draft resolution made up about whether it was feasible to transfer the East Precinct. A spokesperson for the former mayor saying, making a suggestion that it was the Department of Finance and Administrative Services. And then the Department of Finance and Administrative Services turned around and told the Times that it was the Durkin administration, the mayor's office, that triggered this draft resolution. And so, like many things around Chaz CHOP, there's a lot of confusion about what really happened, who made what calls, and, you know, you sure wonder whether those missing text messages would help clear all of this up. But you just have to, this takes you inside what really has become the insanity of Seattle City Hall. That their response to protesters taking over six square blocks of the city was to, A, let them be there for a month and just remove police from the area. People were killed in that area as a result of a lack of police presence. And to consider the absolutely absurd idea, no matter how early the stages of that consideration were, to give a building valued at about $5 million, a building that is a hub for police response in the city, away to protesters as a way to please a group of activists that will never be pleased with anything the city does. And to think that the city even thought that by giving an entire building that would stop what was going on. And the funny thing is, in this draft memo, the city even said at the last line of this memo, the city of Seattle commits to the ongoing maintenance of the building as needed to be determined by Black Lives Matter Seattle King County chapter. So not only was the city going to gift this taxpayer resource, but it was going to continue at the taxpayer expense to provide for the ongoing maintenance operations of that building. Come on, people. Come on. This is absurd. I mean, the things that happen, publicly are bad enough, but behind the scenes, I really struggled to wrap my mind around that way of thinking, that way of governing, and what a blatant disregard even contemplating, even raising the idea of this, what a blatant disregard that shows for the citizens of Seattle and for what should be the primary responsibility of government, and that is to keep its citizens safe from harm. Anyway, I had to give you that update because we talked about Chaz Chop a ton on the podcast. Reading this story, I just thought, this is the epitome of woke culture seeping into government. I wanted to take a few minutes to talk about the death of former Washington State Trooper Robert LeMay. Robert LeMay made headlines because he lost his job as a state trooper over the state's vaccine mandate. And you've probably seen the video where he does his final sign-off from service and tells Jay Inslee to kiss his ass.
This is my final sign-off after 22 years of serving the citizens of the state of Washington, being asked to leave because I am dirty. Numerous fatalities, injuries, I've worked sick, I've played sick. We've buried lots of friends over these years. State 1034, this is the last time you'll hear me in a state patrol car. And Jay Inslee can kiss my ass.
Well, the news came out over the weekend that Robert LeMay has died from COVID-19. Chief Batiste of the Washington State Patrol writing in a statement, "I am deeply saddened over the news that our former friend and colleague, Trooper Robert LeMay, has passed away. This agency's prayers and remembrances are with his family and loved ones. Rob served honorably for over 2 decades, and we were disappointed to see him leave the agency this past October. His service to this state and agency will be long remembered and appreciated. Let us now remember our old friend, support his family and loved ones, give thanks for his service, and resolve to meet the challenges ahead with continuing duty, dignity, and respect." You know, I was at a conference over the weekend as this news came out in Ocean Shores, a political conference where I was moderating a panel, and word of Trooper LeMay's death was spreading around the conference. And I honestly think most people had the same reaction, which is, oh gosh, first, that's horrible. What a loss. But second, how is the media going to cover this? When Doug Erickson, Senator Doug Erickson, passed away, State Senator Doug Erickson, a Republican in Washington State, passed away after a battle with COVID-19 and after being very vocal against mandates, the media and folks online were absolutely vicious about it. It was almost as if they were dancing on his grave, like, I told you so. I said at the time that it was just deeply sad and inappropriate the way that his death was spun for political gain. I feel the same way about Trooper LeMay's death. You know, it's not a time to gloat. It's not a time to say, I told you so. It's not a time for people to be nasty. But that doesn't mean that we have to ignore the fact that, you know, Robert LeMay made a very public statement as it pertained to vaccine mandates. He made a very political statement in what he said about the governor. And frankly, the media would be remiss if it did not revisit that video when talking about his passing. I mean, the only reason a lot of people know the name Robert LeMay is because that video was sent out to the media. And it also is a time where it is appropriate to underscore the reality that vaccines are safe and effective. But at the same time, I've always told people, don't listen to me. Don't listen to talking heads. Don't listen to politicians. Certainly don't listen to people on the internet. Ask your doctor. You know, how many things have you trusted your doctor about over the years? The only person who you should be talking to or hearing from if you have a concern about taking a vaccine is your doctor. Now, that being said, some people just have an issue not with the vaccine, but with being told you have to take the vaccine or you could lose your job. Certainly, that was the case for Robert LeMay, who was not happy with the fact that this was a mandate. So people have asked me, oh, are you going to talk about this? Why are you ignoring the Robert LeMay story? Or, you know, what are you going to say about this? And I guess my question would be, what do you want me to say? Every time I've talked about vaccines and controversies around vaccine mandates, et cetera, I've always said, I am vaccinated. I am fully vaccinated. I believe that it is safe. I believe that it is effective. I believe that the vaccine prevents me from getting as sick or even dying from COVID. But I also don't believe that it is my job to tell people what to do. Just like I don't believe it's the job of politicians to tell people to get a vaccine. It's actually a conversation I got a chance today. I taped an interview with the Secretary of the Washington State Department of Health, Dr. Umair Shah, and we spoke at length about the politicization of the pandemic and of the vaccines. And I think we had a really good, productive conversation that I hope folks on all sides of this issue, you know, pro-mandate, anti-vax, pro-vax, will find helpful in just sort of lowering the temperature around our dialogue and our debate and our discussion on this issue. So again, you know, what do you say about the passing of Robert LeMay? What do you say, you know, about the video he put out and how he died? Honestly, it speaks for itself. And Robert LeMay made a decision as an adult, knowing full well the possible consequences of it. He made a decision that he was not comfortable with the government mandating that he take this vaccine. And he believed so much in his decision that he was willing to sacrifice a career. I am not going to judge Robert LeMay for the decision that he made. Thanks for listening to the Undivided Podcast. I'm Brandi Cruz. As I said, I will have a couple special episodes coming up. Friday, I'm going to have an in-depth interview with State Health Secretary Dr. Umair Shah. I hope you get a chance to listen to that. And then coming up on Monday, I am going to actually use my podcast to feature another podcast that I love and that I think you will really love as well. It's a podcast that is part of this mission to just restore common sense and sanity and fact-based dialogue. It is called the Blocked and Reported Podcast. The co-host of that podcast, Katie Herzog, is going to join me Monday on the Undivided Podcast. So stay tuned for that. As always, I'd be remiss if I didn't try to turn you into paid subscribers to Undivided so I can continue this independent journalism. You can become a paid subscriber in two ways, either on Patreon at patreon.com/undivided, that's patreon.com/undivided, or by becoming a contributor on my Locals community, brandicruz.locals.com. Thank you to the founding sponsor of Undivided, 1530 Mortgage. You can visit them at 1530mortgage.com.